This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we'll talk with author and attorney Jeff Haas about his new book on Fred Hampton.
It's a great book, a real thriller, a page-turner, a true crime story on how the FBI assassinated a promising up-and-coming black nationalist and socialist, Fred Hampton.
We'll talk with legal director Bill Quigley from the Center for Constitutional Rights about a recent lawsuit they filed on behalf of the community group ACORN.
When no one else would take on this case, the center stepped up to the plate.
We'll also hear about how Dr. Terry Ginsburg was hired to teach a film class and was then forced out because her views on the Middle East were considered too controversial.
Yet another travesty of academic freedom brought on us by what you might call Zionist power structure.
Stay with us. We are pleased to have with us author, attorney, and longtime National Lawyers Guild member Jeff Haas. His new book, The Assassination of Fred Hampton, How the FBI and the Chicago Police Murdered a Black Panther, is a page-turning chronicle of the tragic murder of Fred Hampton, the 21-year-old leader of the Chicago Black Panthers. On a dark December day, Chicago police unloaded nearly 100 rounds into Hampton's apartment, leaving his pregnant fiancée, Deborah Johnson, in shock, having barely survived. The killing horrified the black and progressive communities in Chicago. As Haas describes, it took 13 years of grueling litigation from the attorneys at the People's Law Office Collective to finally convict the FBI, the Cook County State's Attorney, Edward Hanrahan, and the Chicago Police for their summary execution of Hampton. Today, 40 years later, the People's Law Office is still active in suing the Chicago police for torturing and extracting false confessions from over 100 black men in a Southside police station. In this long fight, Haas says, quote, "Like others who heard Malcolm X, Dr. King, and Fred Hampton speak in the 60s, I learned that fighting injustice and inequality is the struggle of our lives, and perseverance in this struggle is what makes our lives valuable." We're joined by Jeff Haas to talk more about the book. Jeff, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
You've written an utterly riveting book, and we'd like to first start by finding something out about Fred Hampton, the person. Who was he?
Fred Hampton was a young, dynamic man who, from the start of his, even in his teenage years, he had a real compulsion to fight for justice. And Fred Hampton started in high school, led a walkout because black girls weren't being considered for homecoming queens. Then he took on the issue of not having enough black teachers and no black administrators. And basically, wherever he saw injustice, he felt compelled to deal with it. He got very much involved in a program. There was no place for black kids in Maywood, where he grew up, to swim. The communities demand a recreation center and a swimming pool for black kids. The white kids could go to a nearby suburb and swim at a veteran center, which was segregated. I think also, from an early age, he organized the kids in his neighborhood and brought them over for breakfast on Saturday morning, and he cooked. And he knew a lot of these kids didn't even have breakfast at home. So he started his own, at 10 years old, his own Breakfast for Children program. I think another couple of interesting things about Fred was when he was young, he had supposedly had a big head, and everybody called him Peanut Head. So Fred practiced his repartee, and pretty soon he was king of the nines, or the dozens, as they're sometimes called in New York. And as somebody said, nobody took on his mouth. And even in high school, he also had a lisp, and in order to overcome that, he memorized the speeches of both Dr. King and Malcolm X, and used to go to church with his family, mostly to listen to the cadence and the rhythm of the preachers, so that he would be a good speaker.
Jeff, talk about his family, his mom and dad especially. They were they worked in a factory. They were in the union. They came up from Louisiana. You knew them. Talk to us about that also.
Well, he came from a very warm family. Both his parents grew up in Louisiana on farms where their grandparents had been slaves. They moved to the west side of Chicago, like many blacks who came up. Another family who had come from Moni, Mississippi was Mamie Till. And a matter of fact, I found out that Iberia Hampton, Fred's mother, babysat for Emmett Till when he was a youngster. So Fred was the youngest of three kids. He always remained very close with his family. His mother became a union steward at Corn Products, and his father was also a very strong man. And Fred maintained close relationships with his family throughout his life. Of course, it was a short life. He was only 21 when he was killed.
Jeff, one of the aspects of the book that I really enjoyed was learning actually about your radicalization as a lawyer and over the years how working on this case shaped your views.
Okay. I came from Atlanta, a middle-class Jewish family in Atlanta, somewhat as depicted in the Driving Miss Daisy story. And matter of fact, the writer of that, Alfred Urey, was a close friend of mine, and his mother and my mother Miss Daisy was modeled, were close friends. My grandfather was the lawyer for Leo Frank, the Jewish man in Atlanta who was lynched. He was the head of an Atlanta pencil factory, and a wave of anti-Semitism came over and was fanned by the Hearst papers. And after the judge had commuted his sentence, a lynch mob from Atlanta came out and hung him. And it really set the Jewish community back a long time. My grandfather never wanted to talk about it. My father was mostly a business lawyer, but he did work with the Voter Education Project and John Lewis. At my dad's death, at the memorial service, I read a eulogy by John Lewis to my dad, saying he was one of the unsung heroes of the civil rights movement, helping register hundreds of thousands of blacks to vote. My mother also helped integrate the hotels in Atlanta because she was the head of the Atlanta Committee for International Visitors. On the other hand, I was also a Southern white boy, a middle-class kid, and I grew up, as many were, somewhat raised by blacks. There was this black man who worked on our farm who I idolized, and he taught me how to plow with a mule and how to drive a tractor and things that most kids don't learn how to do. But it was the South, and Walter was his name, used to take my friend Henry and out of the Atlanta Crackers baseball game in Atlanta. But when we got there, Walter had to go sit out on a hill in right field while Henry and I sat in the stands because the park, like everything else in Atlanta in the 50s, was segregated. I think, really, I became more radical when I went north to school, in particular the University of Chicago. My classmates consisted of John Ashcroft and Bernadine Dorn. Ashcroft didn't really have much to say in those days, but Bernadine and I became close friends. She actually got me a job one summer working with a black law firm in Atlanta. So I think being in Chicago in a white law school surrounded by the black community, connecting with the civil rights movement when I went to Atlanta, I was with Dr. King when he marched in Chicago, and also the day that he declared that he was against the war in Vietnam a few weeks before this famous Riverside Church. And it really moved me, and it was really tumultuous times. The anti-war movement was at a peak. The Black Power movement was very strong. There had been riots in the cities. Kennedy and King had been assassinated in 1968. So it seemed like we were headed for the falls or the rapids. We didn't quite know where it was going. And out of this emerged this young leader, Fred Hampton, who I met because I was in Chicago, and Fred had become the leader of the Panthers. And first he was the head of the NAACP youth branch, and then he was in SNCC very briefly. And then when Bobby Rush, who's now a congressman, came back from the West Coast, the first person he wanted to help have him lead the Panthers was Fred Hampton, because he was such a dynamic speaker. Fred could talk to welfare mothers, he could talk to law students, he could talk to gang kids, and all of us were inspired. And so one of the first things I heard Fred speak in August of 1969 and heard the powerful words, and he said, basically, if you're not going to do any revolutionary act when you're 20, you're dead already, and I don't want myself on your mind if you're not going to work for the people. And that commitment, that energy that Fred Hampton had, just affected everybody who heard him speak or saw him work. The Panthers in Chicago grew tremendously in the year from November of 68 when they started until his death in 1969.
In addition to being an engrossing story, the way you've written it is you combine the legal aspects, but in a way that's really easy to read and involves people emotionally. A couple of things happen. We learn, in a way, about your loss of innocence in terms of government, COINTELPRO. We learn about political trials and how they are different from other trials. Maybe telling us a bit about the facts of what happened kind of in a nutshell, can you explain how those developed?
On the morning of December 4th of 1969, this young man who I'd heard speak and just had spent time with a couple of days before, 40 years ago, my partner knocked on my door, and I opened it, and he said, "The chairman is dead. The pigs vamped on his crib this morning." And I went and interviewed the survivors. My partner went to the apartment to examine it. And it just took me back in a way. The police had killed him. I went and interviewed his fiance, who told me they had actually come in the room where Fred was semi-conscious. She was pulled out of the room, and she heard, "Is he dead yet?" And then she heard two shots, and then, "He's good and dead now." And so she told me this terribly riveting story about how her fiance, and she was 8 months pregnant with her son at that time, and then said, "What can you do?" And I certainly didn't know. I couldn't bring Fred back to life. But my partners and I decided to take on his killers. And first we, and with a lot of support from the National Lawyers Guild, the Center for Constitutional Rights, filed a civil suit to find out what happened. And quickly we exposed that the police raid on that morning was really a shoot-in, not a shootout. It was 90 police shots to one shot from the Panthers. We pretty much proved that he was murdered in his bed. We've proven it factually. Then we went to federal court and tried to prove it in a trial. We had a horrible judge, very much like Judge Hoffman in the conspiracy trial. He hated us, he hated our clients, and most of all, he hated the fact that we said the government had murdered this man. And the police were actually under the control of the prosecutor, Edward Hanrahan, a politically motivated prosecutor who was running on a law and order campaign and a war on gangs, and he considered the Panthers a gang. So I think first we were shocked with the raid, the brutality. They went in there with machine guns, shotguns, a rifle. But then 3 years in, we uncovered something that was even more startling, and that was that an FBI informant who we knew very well had provided a floor plan to the raiders that showed the bed where Fred would be sleeping. And that bed was where the shots converged. So we pursued discovery in conjunction with the church committee, and the government stalled and denied. But we learned there was this COINTELPRO program, which targeted the entire left and also the black movement, but the Panthers were its particular target. And we uncovered some startling things. It only took us about 5 years, and 2 months into the trial, we uncovered 200 volumes of files that they had not disclosed. But some of the things we uncovered was that the FBI had sent a letter to Jeff Fort, the head of the Blackstone Rangers, a year before Fred was killed, and told an anonymous letter and said, Dear brother Jeff, I've been hanging out with the Panthers and Fred Hampton. They have a hit out on you. I know what I'd do if I was you. And in addition to that, they said the purpose of this is to seek retaliatory action. Unable to get Jeff Fort to do it, they provided a floor plan and went to Hanrahan and the local police and said, "There are weapons there. Here's a floor plan. Here's the bed where Fred's sleeping." We later uncovered a document which showed the informant got a $300 bonus for providing that floor plan, which they said was invaluable to the success of the raid.
You mention in the book that had that worked, the Jeff Fort letter, if that had been effective, then the government wouldn't have had to go in and assassinate Fred, and this would not have been uncovered.
Exactly. The FBI wanted some other group to do their dirty work. They wanted the Blackstone Rangers to do that. In matter of fact, they worked on creating conflict between the Panthers and other groups, sending cartoons that they said SDS sent out that were racist cartoons and things like that. Unable to do that, they also didn't think they'd ever be caught. They provided this floor plan, and a federal grand jury never disclosed that the informant had provided the floor plan, which was used in the raid. So they still sought to uncover it. This was all part of the COINTELPRO program. Another thing we uncovered, or actually it was some draft dodgers in Pennsylvania went into an FBI office and found these files called COINTELPRO. And the program of COINTELPRO talked about disrupting, destroying, and neutralizing the Black Panther Party and even crippling the Breakfast for Children program, which was a very successful program and one that Fred pushed in Chicago and actually was out there serving breakfast to the kids. But one of the objectives of the COINTELPRO program was prevent the rise of a messiah who could unify and electrify the masses. And it was pursuant to this objective that we think they went in to murder Fred, because he had such a tremendous charismatic effect on anybody who listened to him.
Jeff, you took this on not just as a legal case, but you organized it in a political way. What kind of support did you get from the Black community in Chicago?
Although the Black community was divided around the Panthers, they were not divided around the murder of a young Black leader at 4:30 in his bed. And the Black community came together to protest this. And a young state senator named Harold Washington spoke out, who later became the mayor. Even Ralph Metcalf, who had always done the Mayor Daley's bidding, the earlier Mayor Daley, reacted and opposed the raid. So the community came together strongly. The Panthers led people through the apartment that showed the direction of the bullets was from the police towards the Panthers and proved that the police story was a lie. So we had a great deal of support, and the Panthers helped build that support by showing what happened at the raid.
Jeff Haas, who's written the just magnificent book, The Assassination of Fred Hampton, How the FBI and the Chicago Police Murdered a Black Panther.
Well, I think the coalition that came together to protest the murder of Fred Hampton was the same coalition that eventually elected Harold Washington as Chicago's first Black mayor. And that's, of course, also what attracted Barack Obama to come to Chicago, was the fact that there was a liberal administration there and he felt he could make some changes. So on the one hand, it had some very far-reaching effects. On the other hand, I think the murder of a Black leader, Fred, also led to the dissolution of the party in Chicago. And particularly on the West Side, the increase in drug and gang activity, because the Panthers represented an alternative. They talked about serving the people, building the community, programs like breakfast program and the health clinic, and fighting police brutality. And so I think with the demise of the Panthers and leaders like Fred Hampton, that energy and that anger got focused in different directions, not necessarily in constructive ones.
Sadly, Jeff, it would seem that the government was successful in their goal to destroy the Black Panther Party.
I think they were very effective in doing that. I'm sure there were other issues going on that probably contributed to that, too. But certainly COINTELPRO, Fred Hampton had a slogan saying, you can kill a revolutionary, but you can't kill a revolution. You can kill a freedom fighter, but you can't kill freedom fighting. But I think that's an issue that's not as easily accepted as he would have said. The jury is still out, and I think losing a Black leader like Fred Hampton does set back the people's struggle a lot. I think the FBI understood that. On the other hand, he is remembered today, and his spirit, sort of the non-compromising pursuit of justice, that legacy continues also.
Sadly, it wasn't just Fred Hampton, but we had lost Martin Luther King, who was also a target of COINTELPRO, and Malcolm X.
That's true. And I think the loss of leaders like this has certainly taken a toll in the Black community. And that energy, all of which they were able to focus towards improving the condition of Black people, is no longer directed so clearly. Without leadership like that, I think that energy and anger and so forth gets dispersed. And I think that's one of the questions, not for all of us today, is how do we revive that spirit of change of the 60s? It doesn't mean we all have to have guns or have berets, but that uncompromising need to build a just society, to take on inequalities, even climate change, how do we direct that, build that energy and direct it today to make those changes in our society.
Jeff, we were taken by the way in which the book has been written. It's not a dry legal book. It's really an engaging account. Can you tell us a bit about how you came to write it years after this chain of events?
Well, I guess it was stuck in my claw somewhere. But for the next 35 years after the incident, I was either fighting this case, which lasted 13 years in court, or other civil rights cases. I was one of the lawyers in the Attica brothers case, one of the first lawyers to get into Attica. I defended the Pontiac brothers in Chicago and did a lot of wrongful conviction cases. We uncovered John Birds, the police torturer in Chicago. So I guess for a long time I was just too busy. When I finally, after 35 years, took a break from the People's Law Office, I thought about it, and I said, well, this is a story that needs to be told, both the life and the death of Fred Hampton. But I didn't want to tell it, actually, just as a lawyer from the legal standpoint. I ran into a good friend, the infamous Bill Ayers, and Bill said, well, I went back to Bennington and got an MFA in creative nonfiction. I think you should do that. And so I wanted to write it as a story. I started writing like a lawyer arguing it, and then I realized that's not going to be very interesting. So I got an MFA in creative nonfiction, focusing on memoir style, focusing on storytelling, and on description of scenes and so forth. So I wanted the book to be readable, not just for lawyers.
Well, you certainly succeeded. It's a gripping book. Talk to us about the People's Law Office. It's really a unique outfit there in Chicago, and it's still going strong after all these years. Give us an idea how it was set up and what your mission was.
This was 1969. The Democratic Convention had been in Chicago. The conspiracy trial was starting. The anti-Vietnam War was at a peak. SDS had split. The Weathermen and other factions were declaring national actions in Chicago. And four of us who worked at Legal Aid wanted to be lawyers for this movement. And we couldn't do it at Legal Aid, so we started the People's Law Office in a former sausage shop on the north side of Chicago. And from the days we opened our office, we had the Young Lords and the Young Patriots and the Panthers and SDS and the anti-war movement. We were pretty busy. And I guess we were fortunate. Most of us were young. We didn't have families. We lived collectively, so we didn't need a lot of money. And we were very much inspired by our clients. I think one of the things that kept us going through the Hampton trial for 13 years was the memory of Fred, the irony of we were representing him and his family, and he was dead, and yet what he said inspired us to go on against some pretty tough odds. But that's what the People's Law Office has done since it started. We took on another lawsuit against a police commander who we accused of torturing black suspects. And again, that's taken 15 years, but we finally got him fired. A big case in terms of getting the death penalty and getting Governor Ryan to commute the sentences of everybody on death row in Illinois when he discovered that the confessions that got them convicted had been tortured from them. And People's Law Office continues today to pursue these legal struggles for justice.
Jeff, now that you have a faithful following, we're wondering what your next book is going to be.
I would like to pursue this and tell this story for right now, and I'm very much caught up in going around and very excited to tell the story of both the life and of Fred Hampton, also about COINTELPRO. If I write another book, maybe it will be about how we uncovered this police torturer, John Burge, in Chicago, a Vietnam veteran, an MP, who came back and actually used electroshock and what they call dry submarino, putting typewriter bags over suspects' heads to get them confessions. And that also, that struggle has gone on for 25 years. Burge has been indicted for answering a deposition that he never tortured anybody. So I'd like to do that. And I'd also just like to point out that when I was recently researching an article for The Nation, I uncovered that the people in the 70s who fought hardest against exposing government abuses and intelligence agency abuses were Ford's chief of staff, Donald Rumsfeld, and his aide, Dick Cheney. So they have been working for the imperial presidency for a long time. They obviously seized the day on 9/11 and came very close to accomplishing it. And the struggle to hold the government accountable, whether it be police torture or for actions like COINTELPRO, I think struggles, and it's maybe the struggle of our lives to hold the government accountable. In this case, I think we need to prosecute the torturers at Abu Ghraib in Guantanamo and so that they're not above the law.
Jeff, we look forward to seeing you in New York City and at events around the country.
And we have posted on lawanddisorder.org, our website, your schedule of public appearances here in New York. We're looking forward to seeing you, Jeff. Thank you very much for being on Law and Disorder.
And congratulations on a magnificent book.
Oh, thank you. And I enjoyed talking with you.
Bye-bye. This is Heidi Boghossian from Law and Disorder Radio,
joined by Michael Smith,
here to tell you about three special events commemorating the 40th anniversary of the murder of Fred Hampton.
Jeff Haas, who wrote a terrific, really true crime thriller book, is going to be in town. He's on a panel, Racism, Repression, and Resistance, December 3rd at New York Community Church, 6:30 p.m. Then on December 7th,
he'll be at the Brecht Forum at 7:30 p.m.
along with Red Channel's movie on Fred Hampton. And December 8th, he'll be appearing at Humane Books up in Harlem at 2319 Frederick Douglass Boulevard. And finally,
Jeff Haas will be at Revolution Books on December 9th to talk about his book, to answer questions.
So please come out, meet Jeff, buy and read the book, and take up the struggle.
Center for Constitutional Rights has filed a lawsuit on behalf of the community group ACORN, which was recently barred funding by a congressional resolution. The lawsuit charges that Congress unconstitutionally targeted the organization through what is known as a bill of attainder. The center's legal director, Bill Quigley, says, quote, "With all the crimes and infractions committed by banks, pharmaceutical companies, and private government contractors, they have been rewarded with bailouts, tax credits, and billions of dollars in new contracts. Congress bowed to Fox News and joined in the scapegoating of an organization that helps average Americans going through hard times to get homes, pay their taxes, and vote. Shame on them." We are joined by CCR Legal Director Bill Quigley. Bill, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you.
Now, Congress recently enacted legislation that effectively punishes the nonprofit group ACORN. Can you give us a little background on that?
Yes. ACORN, for the listeners who don't know, is an association of community organizations that has about 500,000 members across the United States. They're in 75 cities, and they have been in existence for 30-something years. And they do voter registration, housing foreclosure work, local issue organizing, and the like. They have been, you know, very controversial, particularly because of their voter registration work. In the last 5 years or so, they've registered more than 2 million people to vote. So they have been a target of the right wing for some time.
Yeah, because the new people coming to register usually don't vote Republican.
That's right. I mean, it's a primarily African American and Latino organization, and they, you know, register folks. They do very aggressive outreach to try to get folks who haven't been registered.
Now, Bill, I saw Fox News was like leading the crusade against ACORN. It looked like a setup to me. They had two people come into an ACORN office asking for financing for selling sex services. What's the story behind that?
Well, apparently there is this right-wing sting operation that was going on that they went to a couple of dozen ACORN housing offices. The people in those offices are, their goal, they're, you know, low-paid workers, but their goal is to try to help people who don't own homes figure ways to be first-time homebuyers. And so these tricksters talked about, you know, they were into prostitution and stuff like that. And the truth is that the people at Acorn, you know, would help you if you're a prostitute or not. And so they tried to, you know, give people some advice, and some of the people went too far and suggested about concealing the nature of their work and that. And so there was, they had a couple of incidents where they, on tape, they got people to say some things that didn't sound so great after, you know, they were played back. And they made a big thing on Fox News about showing this, and when it happened, Acorn did an investigation. They let go several employees that were on that tape, and they hired the Attorney General of Massachusetts to conduct an investigation into what Acorn was doing so they could make sure and prevent this from happening again.
So what happened is that Congress, after that, added a paragraph into a law that establishes a temporary budget for all government programs and forbade Acorn and any of its affiliates, subsidiaries, or allied institutions from receiving any federal funding.
What's wrong with that?
Actually, apart from the politics of punishing people for registering folks to vote, there is a specific part of the United States Constitution that has been in there since the beginning of the Constitution that prohibits what's called a bill of attainder. Now, you know, most of the lawyers out there don't have any idea what a bill of attainder is, much less regular public, and I've never handled a case like this before. But the specific thing in the Constitution, because the United States were familiar with what had happened in England in Parliament, where the people in Parliament would get all fired up about something, and they would just have a specific bill naming a person or organization saying they were outlawed or they couldn't receive any of the benefits of being a citizen of England and that sort of stuff. So the Congress outlawed that, and only rarely has Congress actually even done this, where they single out an individual or an organization for some sort of punishment. And what they did here was, without any hearings in Congress, without any investigation whatsoever, just based really on the rumors and the Fox News sort of stuff, that they said that Acorn and, this is the other part, as you said earlier, any of its subsidiaries or even allies couldn't receive any federal funds. And that's the extent of it. It's a one-sentence prohibition on them getting any money. And it probably impacts quite a number of million dollars of funds. And these funds are not going for big salaries. It's not like a bank or Wall Street or that sort of place. These are going to help people fill out their income tax reform so they'll get the earned income tax thing. They have people who are trying to prevent people from getting their homes foreclosed on. They have done some work around voter registration and the like. So the politics is going after Acorn, which is illegal. But in addition, the punishment is not just of Acorn, it's of these hundreds of thousands of people who are working in their communities all over the country.
How much are we talking about? This can effectively destroy Acorn.
Well, Acorn, they originally took the view that about 10% of their money is federal funds, and they said, well, you know, we're a membership organization. We get dues from people and the like, and, you know, we can gut it out. But they quickly found out, however, that cutting off the federal funds for Acorn is one thing, but then there are Acorn housing organizations around the country who get, you know, almost all of their funds through federal government, either directly or indirectly, and all of those funds froze up as well. And so a lot of the housing work stopped. And then because Congress singled them out for this, a lot of state and local governments also say, well, look, if Congress is doing this, they must have really done something illegal, which, of course, no one has said, you know, not even, there's no indictments against them and nothing like that. And so the state and local funds started freezing up, and then even foundations. So, you know, this is a group that has fought a lot of struggles over the last couple of decades, but this is a tough one that they're in right now.
It has the effect of shaming them publicly. But enter the Center for Constitutional Rights, and you recently filed a civil action, Acorn v. United States of America, to challenge the Bill of Attainder. I understand you filed for a temporary restraining order.
That's right. 2 or 3 weeks ago, the Acorn people came to us and said, look, we have worked with law firms and legal organizations around this country for years, but nobody will help us now because we are so stigmatized by this thing that people just don't want to be associated with us, and would you help us out? And so we put together a team Jules LaBelle, professor at Pitt, Bill Goodman and Julie Hurwitz from Detroit, and a number of volunteers here and across the country, and researched this thing and did file a federal lawsuit last week asking that the federal court in Brooklyn declare this unconstitutional. We had a brief hearing with the judge at the end of last week on a temporary restraining order, and the government sort of surprised us by coming out and saying, look, we haven't totally cut off ACORN. In fact, we have shut down their ability to receive the rest of the grants that they're entitled to and that, but what people need to do is make an individual appeals, and in some cases, we probably will continue to give them money. And with that, the judge said, well, then, if that's the case, which is really, honestly, the first we had heard about it, but if the United States says that to the court, I want the parties to meet and work on that. But in the meantime, she set up a trial date of December the 4th, where she's going to decide whether this violates the Constitution or not. And it was a lot of information to put on the judge in 24 hours. This is a federal judge who is known to be very deliberative and pay attention to details and the like. And so we still remain hopeful, and ACORN is excited to be, fighting back. They've, as was said, been scapegoated a lot over the last couple of months. So as an organization, they are ready to stand up. And we think it's important for the whole left. The far right targeted Van Jones and took him out in pretty much a stealth operation, and now they're trying to take down ACORN. We just think it's important that people recognize that if they can take down ACORN, they're certainly going to go after somebody right after that. And if what they did was legal, then all they have to do is put one sentence in a congressional budget or tack it onto some other bill in January or February, and they'll say no money goes to NAACP, and then no money goes to the SEIU, and no money goes to the and it just can go on and on and on. And that's, in this way, what the framers of the Constitution, they didn't want the Congress to be the prosecutor, judge, jury, and executioner for this stuff. We have a way to do this, and I pay taxes like most of the people listening to the program, and I don't want my money to be misused, and I don't want it to be used for fraud. And if, in fact, there is more to this than just the rumor mongering that's been done, then there's ways to do it. There are extensive laws where different executive agencies, HUD, Department of Justice, IRS, Commerce, anybody can say, look, we suspect that you're involved in something bad and you're misusing our money, and we are going to set up a hearing for us to put our information on the table, you to put yours on the table, and then we'll make a decision whether we're going to suspend these funds until you do A, B, and C or not. But Congress, the right-wingers didn't want to go this way, and so they did an end run, and we hope the court's going to set that aside.
Attorney Bill Quigley, legal director at the Center for Constitutional Rights. Bill, like in the past, the center's doing the right thing here. An injury to one is an injury to all, and we really applaud your stepping up and representing ACORN.
I understand, Bill, that the section of concern, Section 163, went into effect this past October 1st. And then it was extended and is now due to expire on December 18th?
That's correct.
Do you anticipate that it will be extended?
It was extended once already, and we think that by challenging it, that hopefully if we don't win in the court, which we do think we will, but if we don't win in the court, that perhaps the challenge and the raising this sort of unfairness up might stop Congress from extending it. But certainly, they think they have the authority, and the right wing would like to do that.
Bill, it's been a pleasure to have you on. We look forward to having you on again to celebrate what we hope will be a resounding victory.
Thanks so much, Bill.
Thank you all.
In the fall of 2007, Dr. Terry Ginsburg was hired to teach a film class at North Carolina State University, focusing on the media treatment of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. She was also hired to help program a Middle Eastern film series. In a grievance, Terry alleged that the directors of the Film Studies and Middle East Studies program, in a series of decisions, violated her academic freedom. They limited her involvement in the series that she had been hired to curate, and they criticized her introduction to the screening of the Palestinian film Ticket to Jerusalem as biased and overly political. The grievance alleged violations of her First Amendment and equal opportunity rights under the university code. but it was dismissed on the grounds that it was filed too late and that Terry was no longer a university employee. Terry has now filed a lawsuit in which one of the complaints notes that several faculty members view Jews who question and challenge the Zionist colonial project are nonconforming Jews and therefore are outsiders and dangerous. Dr. Terry Ginsberg joins us in the studio today. She has a PhD in cinema studies from New York University and has previously taught in the Jewish Studies program at Dartmouth College and the Cinema Studies program at Rutgers University. We also have with us Terry's lawyer, Rima Capitan. Welcome, both of you, to Law and Disorder.
Thank you so much for having us on.
Thank you.
Terry, let's go back to when you were hired to teach film at the University of North Carolina and what happened.
I was hired to teach at North Carolina State University in Raleigh, North Carolina. I was hired as what is called a teaching assistant professor. I was given a one-year contract with the possibility of renewal. A lot of strong indication during my interview for that position and subsequently by many faculty members, both on and off campus, I was given very strong indication that that teaching assistant professorship would basically convert into a tenure track, a permanent tenure track position, that a tenure track position was opening up. That I should definitely apply for it, that I was effectively the shoe-in for that position. So I moved down from New York City, where I lived for many years, to Raleigh, North Carolina, I mean, thinking that I had actually moved to Raleigh. Not long after I got there, a number of incidents occurred that led me to believe rather strongly that that conversion was not going to take place. And these events showed me that very key faculty members at North Carolina State University were very unhappy with my perspectives on the Israeli-Palestinian conflict and on Zionism.
What is your perspective? The films that you wanted your students to see, what do those films portray?
I should state right out that I'm an anti-Zionist. I'm a Jewish anti-Zionist. And I wanted to really supply a genuinely balanced perspective on the issue of Zionism and the history of Israel and the conflict there as it has been depicted in cinema. So I showed Israeli films. I showed Palestinian films. And actually, there happen to be a number of Israeli films that are quite critical of the occupation, and I showed those rather than only Zionist industry films. I showed the array of cinema on this topic.
Tell us briefly about the university. Is this a small campus? And what is the student body like?
Okay. This is actually a very large campus. I think there are upwards of 30,000 students, maybe close to 40,000 students. And there happens to be a very significant number of Arab and Muslim students on this campus, who I understand from my knowledge of the curriculum are not effectively represented.
So what happened to you in a nutshell? What kind of things did they do to get you out?
Well, I was asked to resign from a Middle Eastern screening series that I had, part of which was what I was hired to do, because I had given an introduction to a Palestinian film during one of the screenings in that festival that was perceived negatively by certain key faculty as quote-unquote pro-Palestinian. So I was asked to resign from that role. I was given a very positive, laudatory teaching evaluation by a key faculty member that also criticized my teaching for showing a film that depicted house demolitions in the occupied territories.
And that was really the only criticism in the review was mm-hmm. the substance of her material.
Rima Capitan, you're an attorney in Chicago. You've started a lawsuit against the university here for what they've done to Terry. Tell us, what are you alleging that they legally violated in terms of Terry's rights?
Well, right now we're alleging that they violated her constitutional rights, her North Carolina constitutional rights. So they breached her right to academic freedom, and they also breached her right to equal protection under the law. The freedom of speech claim, I mean, it's similar to the federal freedom of speech claim. We're simply saying that because of the content of her speech as opposed to the quality of her teaching or her scholarship.
Terry, So you resigned how shortly after you began the job?
Well,
did you complete the full year?
I resigned from the screening series, but not from the job. Oh, no. I performed my job through the entire academic year to the best of my abilities. I stayed there and was hoping for a renewal of the contract and even all along a change in the position of the faculty search committee. I had actually filed a grievance at the university, which was effectively pushed under the rug.
They didn't deal with it when you filed it?
They stalled me, and then finally when I filed it, and it was filed on time, they claimed falsely or wrongly that it was that I had filed too late and that anyway, because I was a temporary faculty member only there on this 1 year and they weren't going to renew me, they didn't have to hear my grievance. So I never received due process on campus.
I remember you telling me that story, Terry, when you came to your first meeting of the Committee for Open Discussion of Zionism. The committee was involved at that time, and you came to defend Joel Covell,
mm-hmm.
whose book was banned at the University of Michigan, and then later he lost his job, same fashion you did. They wouldn't renew his contract at Bard. Rima, I have a question for you.
Sure.
Do you think that your theory of this case on First Amendment equal protection grounds, do you think that that will withstand a dismissal motion?
I don't think so. One of the possible weak points that, you know, we've sort of prepared for when thinking about dismissal is whether or not she has fulfilled her administrative remedies. And because she did the grievance, and a lot of the grievance she did on her own, and that was dismissed on purely procedural grounds. And then we also appealed that under the State Personnel Act in North Carolina, and that was also dismissed for procedural reasons because university professors at North Carolina State are not covered by that act. So she has done everything she could do internally within the university and covered every possible path in terms of suing under North Carolina laws. The only possible route for her now in North Carolina is to do a constitutional claim. So we don't think it'll be dismissed for failure to exhaust her administrative remedies. We have every belief that we have stated a claim under the North Carolina Constitution for the freedom of speech claim and the equal protection claim. Now, the equal protection claim, we're saying that she was being treated differently partly because of her religion. And this is a little bit of an interesting...
It's very interesting.
...theory. And the way we've sort of conceptualized it is that part of the reason she was disliked was because of her religion because of her opinions. So it was not just because of her political opinion, but because of the combination of her opinion and her religion that she was retaliated against or discriminated against.
Terry, Rima, are you saying that because Terry's Jewish, that her anti-Zionist position would carry even more weight?
Exactly. So it wasn't because she was Jewish per se that she was discriminated against, but because she was Jewish and anti-Zionist. That was an unacceptable position.
Let's put this persecution of Terry in context, because she's certainly not the first professor to lose her job because of her anti-Zionist views. Terry, I think you're very familiar with other people who have been victimized by campus administrations because of their views. What would you conclude in terms of the scorecard so far? Norman Finkelstein was forced out.
Right.
Joel Covell was forced out.
Right.
What can one expect if they're not intimidated by the kind of Zionist lobby, if you will, and state their opinion forthrightly like you did? What can they expect as a professor across this this country?
They can expect to have what have happened to them, what happened to me, what happened to Finkelstein, what happened to Joel Covell. The atmosphere is increasingly worse, not only for Jews, but anyone who speaks out on this issue, and also especially for non-tenured and temporary academic labor. You know, all three of us, Covell, Finkelstein, and I, fall into that category. I mean, Finkelstein was not yet tenured.
Terry, what kind of support did you have on campus? Did other faculty members come to you and say they sympathized?
Well, yes and no. I had minimal support from the AAUP representative, who early on backed out And really, I think the AAUP failed to support me until we put out a petition, which received over 500 signatures. And we sent that petition to the AAUP, and they then sent a letter of support to the University of North Carolina administration, stating that they felt it was wrong that I wasn't given due process as temporary academic labor. Most faculty on campus really shunned me. Were really afraid to communicate with me over email, over telephone. I was really isolated after this all started to become known on the campus, and I tried to approach people and complain about it. The more I complained, the more I was isolated.
Were there activist groups, any Arab American groups on campus that students rise up?
Yes. There's an Arab American students organization, a Muslim students organization, that was very supportive. But you have to understand, North Carolina State is really, the region is very oppressive, and the state historically is a red state, and Raleigh itself is quite Republican. And there's a lot of fear and intimidation. With respect to speaking out on a host of issues, and especially on this.
It's important to understand, just to reinforce Terry's point, how controversial this particular issue is and how much fear there is surrounding this issue. I mean, there's fear generally in most employment cases, just to speak as an employment attorney, when faculty members or any employees are still working at the employer that's alleged to have discriminated. They're often hesitant to come forward and support the professor. But in this case also, because of the Palestinian-Israeli issue, I mean, it's just a very, for some reason, controversial national issue. And, I mean, you have, one of the founders of Human Rights Watch coming out and speaking out against the Goldstein, which criticized Israel. So it's just a very, people shy away from this issue, even when they normally would support, let's say, more liberal causes.
Why do you think that is, Terry?
An answer to that question could get us into several hour-long analysis of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict in relation to U.S. policy, foreign policy, and domestic policy, but there's a connection. I think that the Israeli-Palestinian conflict is one of the core issues facing the United States. It's connected to the American intervention in Iraq and Afghanistan. It's connected to American imperialism, capitalist imperialism, with respect to the oil industry, with respect to the military-industrial complex that lies at the core of the contemporary American and global economy. And so to start talking about that core issue seriously, just simply by beginning to demystify the history that we have all been told about it, I mean, just to start that is already considered dangerous by the powers that be, who have a lot at stake in upholding these larger political structures.
I'm awfully sorry I didn't have you as a professor. and I'm really sorry that these students in North Carolina aren't going to have you too.
Well, let's talk about that. I mean, you're in the field of film, and that is a small, as I understand it, field within academia. How has your reputation been affected? What are your chances for employment?
Well, yes, it's a small field, so gossip travels fast. And I'm unemployed. I'm on unemployment right now. This incident, if you will, at North Carolina State has negatively impacted on my ability to find work, especially because I haven't been given the opportunity, I haven't been given due process, I haven't been given the opportunity to clear my name publicly, which I can do if I'm allowed to. So, yeah, this has been really bad. And, students are suffering because of the exclusion of professors like me, including me. They're not being given the opportunity to hear the wide range of perspectives on this, the widest range of perspectives on this issue.
The fact that we've seen this happening on campuses across the country, the freedom of speech issues involved are terrifying on what is supposed to be the bastion of intellectual idea exchange.
Yeah, well, that's what the Germans claimed for themselves, too, when they got rid of all their liberal Jewish professors in the mid-30s. It's a decadence that's setting in on the university campus. And to see that you get no support from your fellow teachers is really pitiful. Terry, let me switch and ask you if I might, something personal. We're speaking with Terry Ginsberg, PhD from NYU Film School, really one of the top intellectuals in her field who was fired because she's in support of the Palestinians. She's teaching film at North Carolina State, and they got rid of her. Terry, let me ask you personally, as a Jewish anti-Zionist, what was it that caused you to take the position, which must be an uncomfortable one, with other people in your family, certainly with the faculty at the school you tried to teach at? What was it that brought you around to the way you think about the situation of the Palestinians?
Well, first of all, I was never really a convinced Zionist growing up. I actually didn't come from a strongly Zionist background, but yes, Zionist discourse and ideology did circulate in my Jewish community. What really brought me to speak publicly and to write, to do scholarly work on this issue, to teach about it, was my work on the Holocaust film. As I read and studied the history of that event and the history of its representation in cinema, which is much more contemporary than the event itself, I couldn't ignore the relationship between the structural relationship between the Holocaust and the Nakba. The Nakba, its legacy, have been enacted in the name of the Jews, of supplying safety for the Jews in this place. And I want to say, well, no, not in my name will this continue.
I'd say the same thing. Nakba means a catastrophe in Arabic.
Rima, I'd like to ask, when was the case filed? What is the next step?
Last week, and the next step, we're waiting for the defendant to file an answer to the complaint.
And that's the university itself?
Right. Then we go forward with discovery, which is exchange of information and documents.
Terry Ginsberg, Rima Kapitan, how can our listeners learn more about your case? How can they support you? Tell us how they can connect.
My law firm has a website. It's mllaw.com, and that's spelled AMAL-LAW.com.
Great.
Generally, I mean, there are all kinds of academic freedom websites, and I really think that the most important thing is to continue dialogue about the Palestinian-Israeli conflict for people who are not necessarily invested in the conflict one way or another to come out in support of the principle of academic freedom, to say strongly that whether or not we agree with X or Y professor, it's important that this issue be talked about on university campuses of all places.
Well, we hope to have both of you back on with a positive development in this really important case.
Thank you, Terry. Thank you, Rima, for being on Law and Disorder.
Thank you for having us.
Thanks.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org.